Okay, yes, are there any questions at this time? Yeah.
I wanted to ask about the neutral field.
Mm-hmm.
Because I understand about bowing front rail mentally.
Yeah.
I thought about it now with the body, because I have parts in the body that doesn't feel pleasant, it don't feel unpleasant. So
yeah.
Is there neutral, or is there something else that I need to deal with?
Yeah, it really kind of depends. Like, so if we think about it less as them really being neutral, but it's kind of the way we relate to them. It's kind of I find it helpful to think of it like strategy thinking. You know, kind of we're kind of thinking, oh, I like this. You know, I want more of this, and that kind of movement to it. And then there can be that feeling of like, oh, I don't like this. I need to get rid of this. And so that's the kind of really important noticing in the Vedana. But what's really interesting to see, yeah, as you say, and then that kind of grows and goes on like this. And so the other way is like, what's actually, I'm not noticing. I'm just kind of overlooking, ignoring, not really kind of paying attention to. And that can be a way of noticing the things which are not getting labeled in that way. But there's kind of an investigation quality with this kind of neutral area. Is there anything that's really neutral, like really in that middle area? And it becomes quite interesting when we notice in any experience there's always like a range. Like I kind of have, this is my top pleasant Vedana type of categorization, but there may be experiences I've never had which kind of would be someone else's pleasant thing, and then the unpleasant, and then there's kind of, you know, and then we have a new pain. It's like, okay, right, redraw the scale. But this area in the middle where we're kind of saying it's not clearly pleasant, it's not clearly unpleasant, is also empty. It's this empty phrase in a way that, you know, if I've done something that's really painful in my leg, and then it kind of comes back and it's a little bit less, is it now pleasant, or is it kind of neutral, or is it still a little bit unpleasant? And we actually think, oh wow, it's very, very hard to say. Like, I'm now quite happy about it not being really painful. So it's kind of, it's quite playful, it's quite empty in that way. Of being really kind of clearly something or the other. But the real benefit is that we want to explore the whole of the body. And the real interest is like, well, if this isn't clearly pleasant, this isn't clearly unpleasant, what's it like to spend time here? You know, and that I think is kind of perhaps even more interesting than all the rest. It's like, if I really stay in with the neutral, you know, kind of stay in with something that doesn't really grab my attention, what happens? And I think that what we kind of feel many times is like it's coming alive, like from the attention that I'm giving it, it's kind of coming into being. It's starting to take up more space. And that can be quite nice in a way. And then it kind of, oh, okay, now you're pleasant. There's kind of no question. But if that's possible, if paying attention can change something from neutral and ignored to pleasant, that kind of suggests that there are more pleasant experiences available to us than we need to go out to buy things and get things or change people so that we feel okay. So that whole kind of Vedana exploration starts to lead us into a deeper exploration of where does happiness actually come from? You know, what is actually a way of generating our own well-being? Yeah. Does that make sense towards the question? Yeah, great, thank you. Hi, yeah.
We keep using two words in our practice, perception and attention.
Yes.
Are they the same, are they different? How can we use them in a useful way in our practice?
Yes, great. Okay, so attention and perception, how are they different? How are they the same? How are they entwined together, and what do we really mean when we use them? So attention is that which we are giving our presence to. Yes, so that's that quality of attention. And perception is actually the isolating out from all of the stuff into objects. Okay, so like literally, if we go like back, even before what we're really meaning by perception, but just to kind of give like a fantastic kind of idea, is right now eyes receive light, yeah? And with that light, they turn it into colors and they turn it into objects. So that's a process in the mind, right? That's not what eyes see. Eyes don't see objects. Eyes see photons, they see light, and they turn that into objects. So that turning of things into objects is one level of perception, but also attention and perception get entwined together when we start to perceive that which is important to me, right? So that's really where perception becomes very interesting, is like, what are we seeing in this moment? So right now, because I'm talking to you, maybe you've very kindly given me more importance than the other people in the room, but we can then play with giving more attention to the other people in the room and include them into our perception, right? Does that kind of make sense? So we kind of stretch the attention and then we perceive more. Or we could say that we're actually opening perception to perceive and include other objects. So they kind of dance together, and the more we look at these kind of definitions of things, we realize that they're all actually tied up together, and perception and attention really lean on each other and rely on each other to exist. So, yeah, thanks for pointing that out. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, hello. I'll go for you, and then, yeah. Yes, noticing patterns.
Reacting, right?
Yes, yes.
And the question is that my experience is that some patterns don't get dissolved by the present unpleasant and noting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they might be so. Some of them are just like on an endless loop.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's true that the attitude towards them is much lighter. Okay.
That's good. Yeah, yeah.
But they don't really dissolve.
Mm.
Or maybe my expectations.
Mm. Yeah. So this is a really great point. So basically, we're noticing that there are these patterns, and that in itself is a really kind of wonderful sense of freedom, that we notice that there's a pattern in my thinking, I notice there's a pattern in my habits, and that if I follow them, then I'm getting a sense of what kind of a pattern I become, in a way, we could say. That we know who I will be if I follow this thought, because I've been down this way and I recognize the pattern. And yet, recognizing the pattern doesn't actually stop the wheels of the mechanism, you know. So I like to say in meditation, there's no brake, yeah. We can just take our foot off the accelerator. And we'll see, this pattern is still continuing. It's, you know, had the momentum of a lifetime, and it's enjoyed us pushing the accelerator. And it may be in some subtle way, we are still pushing it, you know, to kind of keep it going. But we're not intentionally doing that. So there's a lot of contributing factors that lead to these patterns. But what's interesting is that when we observe them, we cease to be identified within them. And that's really a big reduce in the gas, in the acceleration, reduce in the fuel that we're putting into them. And it's not that they will stop and stop bothering us in this way, But they're starting to change. And the key thing that we're changing is our relationship to the pattern. And that in itself, if we kind of notice it, it's like, actually, that's a lot more easy. And a lot more easy is sometimes it's enough, you know. But if we lose that attention, we'll find ourselves back in there. You know, and back in there and believing it. It's like, yeah, I do have to do this thing. And yeah, that really is important, actually. And, you know. And then we'll go, I fell into it again because the patterning of it didn't stop. So a lot of what we're doing is noticing what's there, noticing the pattern and resisting the urge to go into it and think, maybe it's like, oh, this is unpleasant. And that we can kind of rest at that level for some time. And then we'll fall into it and we'll do it and then we'll come out and say, yeah, it was unpleasant, you know. And it's okay, you know, bit of humor. I mean, fine. We're not going to be, you know, switching from one mode to another. You know, there's not like a handy switch from, you know, oh, I've left it switched on dukkha again. You know, I just pop it back onto ease and okay, that's good. I wonder who did that, you know. It's like a gentle recreating the conditions in which we can make small changes which lead to more ease. And if we can do small things, that's great, because it all contributes to the overall patterning of our life.
So some dukkha will remain.
For us, probably, yeah. Yeah, basically. Some dukkha will remain. Yeah. And I think, you know, I think for most of us, there will be some degree of dukkha. And in some expressions of the teachings, we could even say, if there is like manifest existence, if there is the appearance of things, there is some degree, some demanding for these things to appear. You know, the real absence of dukkha is the real kind of absence of things. Kind of in that kind of full sense, if you kind of like follow exactly where these kind of teachings are pointing towards. But I think what we're looking for is kind of adjusting the volume, like more ease, seeing the patterns and not indulging in them, not supporting them, not applying the acceleration, just taking our foot off the accelerator in that way. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Hey.
Is there a systemized way to work with Vedana?
Yeah, I think that can be really useful. As you mean, kind of like as a way of really getting to know the different types of Vedana and spend a bit of time with different ones. And
I just feel sometimes really confused with like what practice should I do?
Yeah.
And there's confusion there.
Yeah, sure. Sure. So, you know, confusion is kind of something that we can expect on a retreat like this where there's quite a lot of suggestions and directions and like, oh, you could do this, or you could do this, or you could do this. You know, we're kind of in a, you know, instead of they're just like here for our meal, it's not like, you know, we have a choice. And it's quite lovely, isn't it? You know, saying, okay, this is the meal. No choice, no difficulty, no confusion, you know. Whereas with choice comes a level of confusion. And what can be helpful sometimes is also just to notice, confusion has a Vedana, right? This is unpleasant. It's unpleasant to have so much choice because it means I might do the wrong thing. And so, thinking I might do the wrong thing is the unpleasantness in the confusion. Like confusion feels like it's going to lead me to doing something wrong. So we can see, actually, I don't need to think this way. There isn't something wrong. There's just a whole choice of right things. And we can just look at it that way. And sometimes that can be enough. That can be quite helpful, isn't it? Then that kind of reintroduces actually the playfulness. You know, it's like anything that we do, we can learn from. So just do that and pay attention. And then it becomes a little bit simpler in that way. And we might feel that it would be helpful and feel free to explore it. You know, I'm going to do a body scan and I'm going to look for different types of Vedana. But when we do something, if we can be reasonably clear about why we're doing it, yeah. Okay, I'm looking for different types of Vedana to get a sense of how they feel and how they and what they lead to. Yeah. So when we touch into an unpleasant Vedana, how does it really feel? What is unpleasant Vedana, the actual sensations of this thing I'm calling unpleasant, what does that really feel like? And what does just really feeling it lead to? And what does not really feeling it and saying, yeah, this is unpleasant and I need to do something about it, kind of lead to? So what is the wisdom and the ignorance difference in the Vedana? have that effect. And then I think Vedana is just great to just drop in any time through the day of like, huh, what's the Vedana of this? And then we can notice, ah, yes, I don't like it. I'm probably going to try and escape from this moment, either into getting something else or getting rid of that through one way or the other. Yeah. Thanks. Hi. Yeah.
I wonder where is the border when we are changing things from outside. I mean, we have our feelings and pain and body. And I want to give the example of what happened with their condition.
Yeah.
Was very, very cold.
Yes.
I could sit here.
Yes.
And say it's very cold and to feel it and where it's painful and to cover myself.
Yes.
And I can change because I already changed from outside the natural things of nature.
Yes.
So where is the border between I'm going to look at what happened or I'm going to change it from outside in order to be for me good or for other people and for nature and electricity and,
yeah,
and noise and things that we are changing in climate and things like this.
Yeah, yeah. So great. That's a really good question as well. And I think it's certainly something that I had a kind of a line in my talk last night, and I kind of was kind of live editing out parts, and it didn't kind of come through in the end. It just, as you said it kind of reminded me, is that the goal of meditation is not to go with the flow. You know, it's not that we're just going to go with the flow, but we're going to notice things. What it's really helpful for, as you were saying, is the internal. Actually, what we need internally is a lot more acceptance, is a lot more allowing, is a lot more welcoming, right? Because it's already arisen within us, right? Otherwise, we have this kind of, almost like a civil war within ourselves, and that's creating more and more restlessness, more and more dukkha. But then we have our relationship to the outer world, and there are some things in the outer world which are wrong, right? Because people are not always 100% skillful, and they don't see things, you know, 100% as well as we do, and we can see, ah, actually, maybe, you know, there are other ways of resolving this situation. So the really important thing is that we work on ourselves so that we're not reactive to our own inner process. We're actually quite spacious and we're quite open. And then we can express ourselves really beautifully and very clearly, like you just did then, and kind of expressing why that could not be a great thing to do, you know. Even aside from the fact that this is blowing cold air on me, like, what else is this doing? What are the other impacts? And so we can cultivate the Vedana within so that we actually see it. And we see, ah, this is unpleasant. This could lead to reactivity, but I can be with this, and I can be with this. Ah, but actually, you know, it's caused by other causes and conditions. And is this a good thing? And then we're looking now from a really kind of wise, centered, deeply rooted, sensitive way. And who should I speak to? How should we approach this? And what can we do to kind of change these outer situations? So that's really not going with the flow. It's contributing in the most beneficial way for the welfare of all. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Hey, yeah. Yeah, sure.
The teaching say there is a pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, and a pleasant and not unpleasant.
Yes.
But ultimately when I look deeper into stuff, it seems like it is all in the middle.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
In the middle. Not pleasant.
Neither nor. Yeah.
So, where is the present? Where is the unpleasant?
Mm. Yeah. So, if let's say, you know, we kind of play with this kind of range sense again. Yeah. So, when you, you know, so say if we kind of like take an example, like stubbing the toe is something that we've all done, you know, where you hit your toe into something like stone and whatever. And then when you feel that, does that feel unpleasant to you?
First moment, yes.
Yeah.
Then no.
Okay. So it sounds like you're resting in somewhere that's very kind of spacious and allowing for, you know, kind of directly meeting the sensations in a way that they don't become very problematic for you. So it could be, it's a potential, and I'm not joking, you know, it means that perhaps you actually have a very clear sense of that Vedana itself is fabricated, it's made up. You know, the Vedana of an object isn't in the object necessarily. We could stub our toe and contemplate, oh, how lovely it is to have sensation in my toe, you know, and then that actually makes the experience very, very fine, you know. Or it could be, this doesn't matter too much, you know, this will pass, this is just arising and passing, and it becomes closer to what you're, you know, referring to as this kind of neither nor mode. So our way of looking also generates the Vedana. You know, I was kind of saying that in the thing. That if we're looking with a meta way of looking, you know, things that we weren't really maybe that bothered about, like this kind of sheeted print of paper, you know, so, you know, I might look at it and think, oh, it's just really lovely, you know. Like just something, you know, all that goes into that thing can just touch me and feel very lovely. Or I could be in a kind of a negative or a very kind of bland mood and I might think, it's just a bit of paper, you know. Means nothing, touches me in no particular way. So our general mood also contributes to the Vedanas which we pick up on. And so if our mood is very kind of stable and balanced and not kind of pulling either way, we may notice that most of the Vedanas we experience are quite steady. But there'll still be this kind of range between them, you know. And so just kind of noticing, if the range is just this much, there's still this kind of movement, different things, different ways of breathing can feel, I can generate more space. Does that feel nicer? You know, or I could come in closer and get more intense. Does that feel nicer or less nice? So there's still kind of some, what we might say like a dynamic range is shorter, but it's still dynamic, it's still moving, it's still fluid. Do you think? Yeah. All right, that's great. Yeah, and it may be that you know, you really experience things very differently, you know, and or this isn't a good exploration for you at this time or for anyone at this time. It can also be possible. So, you know, this quality of appropriate attention is really beneficial and supportive to attune to. You know, what's the appropriate thing to pay attention to? If this practice really works for me, it really changes my experience. Or it might be that this is really fully developed already for me and there isn't something more, something juicy in seeing life this way.
It sounds like just step in the realization of the emptiness of everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I would say it certainly is. Yeah. You know, that the way things appear is dependent on their Vedana, and the Vedana is added on after the object has arisen by the mind. Which certainly suggests quite a lot of emptiness right there, as you rightly point out. Yeah. Thanks. Hi.
I have a question. What do we do about falling asleep? Is like, I can't help it, like every meditation. It's like something unbearable. I don't know what to do with it.
Yeah. And so I guess if that was just happening, you probably saw it as unpleasant, and that didn't necessarily...
I didn't manage, like, okay, that's it, this is vague now, I'm falling asleep, and try to hold it, but...
Yeah. And is it particularly in the meditations that this is happening? The falling asleep? Is it...
I'm not falling asleep in the rest of the day. Like, no.
No.
In the meditation, especially in the guided meditation.
Mm.
Like, I can't help it. And and I'm crying and I say, okay, this is vagina, it's one of the demons, it's like, it arises, but...
Right. And have you tried standing up in meditation?
No.
Well, you know, there's kind of a number of things that kind of, that generate that feeling of like this would be a good time to fall asleep. You know, so if we are comfortable, if we feel a good temperature, and there's not anything particularly to think about, there's not anything particularly to worry about, you know, there isn't something to kind of do, then the mind might think, oh, I recognize this. This is falling asleep time, you know. And so it kind of sinks away. And we'll feel literally like a downward kind of pull into the ground, into the earth. So I was saying yesterday, you know, we can kind of breathe in this way of like breathing up as if there's roots beneath and out into the tree above. And this kind of starts to kind of move the energy in this other way. And instead of kind of darkening and sinking down, it brightens and moves up. So we're kind of purposefully opening out, and we might really kind of like, almost as if we're kind of being pulled up by it into the sky. And actually, when we really think about it, where does sky begin? Like, sky is just here, it's coming down. We're in the sky actually already. We kind of just like come more into the sky. It's like, oh, I'm going to be in the sky, I'm in the sky. And it's kind of uplifting and bright and awakening like this. And the posture that really says that is just to stand up and stand like a tree, you know, and whatever is going to be kind of supportive of that. And you might find it more tiring, but you can actually kind of get used to it. Keep the knees soft, keep the hips soft and the shoulders soft and the arms soft, and, you know, and the body well aligned like this. And then, you know, that can kind of support us through sleepiness.
What is the difference between changing the pose, moving, and doing this?
Changing the pose?
Changing the pose because I'm not comfortable and all this stuff.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And then moving, it's like the same. Am I clear?
Yeah, I think so. So you're talking about moving the posture, as in kind of making adjustments and then settling again. So I don't know if this is entirely true, but my impression is that we can send a signal to the mind through the body by not moving, which is that everything is fine, nothing more to think about, and the body and the mind start, the heart and mind start to just kind of calm and ease into some kind of space. And then when that happens, we kind of notice more things going on in the body, more kind of neutral things, maybe more kind of pleasant things, and that kind of starts to generate also this upward movement of energy and this kind of brightening of the mind and heart and an ease in the body. And this kind of cycle continues to kind of support itself through that sense of stillness in the posture that we have taken. So if we already contribute towards that kind of upward movement, then we're actually in support of that activity, which will kind of come from the staying still. So we're actually staying still, but we're already kind of just one step ahead, and we're encouraging this movement of the breath up and through and brighter, up and through and brighter. So if we just kind of move from here, and it's like, oh, I don't like it here anymore, like, let's move to here, then we're kind of encouraging the mind, which needs to fix it. Yeah, it's like, body's not comfortable. Well, we can't have that. Okay, no. Okay, maybe this bit, yeah. And after a while, it'll become uncomfortable again. But if we breathe in this way that's got more space, maybe that also supports the body to actually feel a bit more comfortable, a bit more enlivened, and all of those factors come together in that way. Who knows? Maybe.
The body conditions the mind.
Yeah, and vice versa, yeah. And the body is known in the mind, yeah.
But how could I know if to change or to stay? This is like, stay, now it's more confusing.
Yeah, stay as much as you can without moving the body. And if you need to move the body, really kind of encouraging lots and lots of well-wishing towards the body and lots of good mindful connection, and then just moving it as little as you need, and then coming back to the whatever you're doing generally in that meditation, wherever you're choosing to place your attention in that meditation.
Get up and stand and then sit down again.
So I mean one posture for the whole meditation.
Oh.
Yeah, so like standing for the whole meditation,
okay.
If you can. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, thank you. Thanks.
About the practicality of the Vedana, I don't really get it as a practice.
Okay.
Let's say what this guy described as neutral, I would describe as pleasant and unpleasant. For example, I hit my toe and I think, ouch, it's painful, but
yeah.
Also, oh, it's so nice to have this sensibility or
yeah.
Something to work with.
Yeah.
So it's not neutral at all, it's everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when I try to see the Vedanas, then I see all together, and I'm just getting like I'm doing the investigation all the time, and it doesn't feel like a stable practice.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to make sure I got your, like the suggestion is to treat Vedana like a layer above some more formal practice, or is it a practice for its own?
Yeah, so it can really depend. So I think it's great what you're describing. So basically, we can stub our toe, and we could say, on a physical level, in that toe, it's unpleasant. But if we look from a kind of a broader perspective, we can see, the toe is working just as it should be. The nervous system is working just as it should be. The mind is working just as it should be. I know that I've stubbed my toe, and I know that I need to do something, rub it, put it in cold water, give it some attention, and all of this. And so we're noticing that there are multiple Vedanas. And then it might come in, it's like, and I've stubbed my toe again. That's the third time this week. I'm really stupid. You know. And then there's the Vedana that's associated with that thought. You know, and that judgment and all of that. So there's always a Vedana whenever there's contact. The more contact we're aware of, the more Vedanas we become aware of, right? And those Vedanas may be really very, very different. And somehow they all make up this experience.
Yeah, but how can I go and search for them when I try to practice meditation?
Yeah, so in the example of this with the foot, you know, we can notice that we are contributing to a different Vedana. But in that moment, when you look at that foot as, it's working well, we are attuned to a Vedana which has a more kind of pleasantness to it, right? What has happened to that toe Vedana now when we tune into it, right? Is it still unpleasant? Or as this person was saying, has it become more neutral now? Because it's also held within a lens. So it's not that there are lots and lots of Vedanas all the time happening. There is actually only one Vedana after each other. It depends on what you look at. In that moment, there's only one moment of contact. In any one moment, there's just one moment of contact. So say right now, we can have a moment of contact with the toe. After that, we have a moment of contact with, you know, the nervous system is working, you know. Or now we could have a general sense of what it's like to be in this room. And then we could have a general sense of, like, what it's like, the pattern of thinking I'm in at the moment. Or what it's like, the feeling of my knees. You know, so constantly we turn our attention and then we notice a contact and we notice that there's a Vedana and we notice that that could escalate. Yeah. So all the time, it's actually more simple than it first appears. Like it seems like, it's just Vedanas everywhere. But actually, there's only a Vedana when we contact that thing. Yeah. And we're constantly contacting things all the time. You know, the mind moves incredibly fast. But when we notice it, we can just notice, what's the Vedana here? And that kind of brings us back.
Yeah, but you can easily do that when an incident happens, but how can you go and look for it as a intentional practice.
Mm-hmm. So probably what's most useful is it really kind of depends on the degree of calmness that we have. Yeah. So if there's already a lot of calmness, this is a practice that can really be very helpful to kind of bring into ongoing things. If there isn't a lot of calmness, it can simply be useful to notice that if I'm in a whole kind of world of thoughts, you know, this kind of papancha world of thoughts that I've made up, I can just notice, what's the Vedana of this? And in noticing that, we drop out of that feeling of the problematicness of it to just notice, it's unpleasant to be doing this. And that kind of encourages us both to have stepped out of that experience and gained a bit more space, and also to be able to see, is this something I want to be doing? You know? And gives us that freedom of choice.
But it's from time to time. It's not like 45 minutes I'm working with Vedana.
Yeah, so it's really up to you. And, you know, what I was saying is that for most of the time I would do the calming practices, whether that's being with the metta, being with the breath, being with the body in those ways. And sometime through the day, seeing if we can just notice all three types of Vedana through the day at some time. Yeah, so that by the end of the day, we've been with a pleasant Vedana, we've been with an unpleasant Vedana, we've been with a neutral Vedana. Yeah.
Is there time for another one? Or
question? Yes, sure.
Yeah. So, working with Vedanas, when I can see them, so I see them and I know good, mm-hmm. neutral, or changing. And there are the times that something distracts me in a way that I cannot notice it. Happens. I have a list, actually, of things that usually when they appear, so I know that later on, if I looked back,
mm-hmm.
this is something that made me unaware.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I wonder if there is a skillful way of practice that I can do that. Even with these things, I could be aware.
Yeah, sure. So basically, if we're distracted, then in a way, like, we just have to accept that, right? Like, we're distracted. Because the state of distraction is not the moment of noticing that we're distracted, right? That's a moment of mindfulness, right? But if we're really distracted, and we're distracted about being distracted, then, you know, we can only wait until we come back and there's a moment of mindfulness. Maybe someone coughs, you know, maybe there's some pain in the body or something, like, brings our attention back to the direct moment that we're here. That moment of contact has a Vedana. That moment of noticing I've been distracted has a Vedana, yeah? And so if we rest there, then we won't go into the whole more kind of problematic things. But if we're fully distracted, there's no way of applying mindfulness to that moment until we come back and there is a moment of mindfulness, there is a moment of presence. Yeah. So, yeah, we can have a long list of things that we fall down in. But whenever we're having a present moment experience, there's a moment of contact and there's a Vedana there. And then that gives us that potential for freedom and not escalation.
And also one more small thing. Mm-hmm. I experience in this practice really excruciating pain in my leg.
Yeah.
And I don't know what is the time to move.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I can look at it and I can observe, but I'm never sure when is the right time to do something about it.
Mm. You know, it's tricky because obviously, you know, we can't trade experiences and I can tell you, that much I think you can do more, you know. Like, now I think you're hurting yourself. Yeah. Like, so we have to explore it for ourselves. Am I doing serious harm to myself, or is this just an unpleasant Vedana?
That thought is bothering me, so I don't.
Yeah. Well, see, like, you know, go longer, and if you can still walk out of here, you know, after a minute or two, like, it's just that it fell asleep, you know. Or am I actually damaging myself? And just kind of check in with the anatomy and things like this. If you're kneeling like this, it might be useful to put something under here so that this isn't a stretch that you're doing all of the time. Yeah.
Under the ankle?
Here, yeah. And then that'll give you a bit more support on that bend. Otherwise, it's really quite a stretch.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. good. Okay, just one more.
How do you know when you are actually doing vegana the right way?
Mm-hmm.
Or that you are detaching yourself from experiences and situations that at the moment are unpleasant for you, but might be also important and deep for your understanding?
Yeah, so I think that's a really great question. I mean, basically, in a very kind of broad terms, and I'll say it in a kind of short time because I think soon they'll ring our bell as well and we'll need to give the hall back to silence. But if we think about it, like, it appears to us that we're really being with our experience and that if we do Vedana, then we're kind of stepping away from the experience. But I think that what Vedana is actually doing is widening the lens, and we're seeing more of what is making up this experience. And noticing that this is unpleasant, right? Whatever it is, just kind of noticing that in addition to what it actually is, actually supports us to come closer to it. So if we have like a pain in the body, if we just kind of say, I've got a pain in my knee, and I feel that it's unpleasant, then I feel like I don't want this pain in my knee. You know, and I'm going to do something to get rid of this pain in my knee. And, you know, or I'll kind of think, well, if I go off and, like, dream about this thing, I won't need to pay attention to it so much. And what we see is that a lot of what we're doing is escaping from this experience. So, and actually noticing, ah, this feels unpleasant. We're more free to come in closer and, like, well, actually, what is unpleasant about this? Is it the pressure? Is it the heat? You know, what's causing this to be unpleasant? Is it some story? You know, is it some attachment to something somewhere? And we actually notice the Vedana is like a way of coming in closer. So, and it also kind of dissolves a little bit this feeling, it's my pain. It's actually happening in the knee in some way, and it kind of resolves and dissolves and maybe even changes from getting kind attention, which is what the Vedana is kind of allowing us to do. Because we're noticing, I'm being reactive. Oh, I can be responsive, I can be kind, I can come closer, I can get into here. So actually, I think that the Vedana isn't really a mode for escape. It's a mode for kind of lessening the identification and lessening the sense of problem and actually bringing us in closer to the directed experience. Okay, I think we should probably leave it at that. All right, thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.